the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben, this is Johnny. Johnny, how are you this week?
Yeah, doing not too bad. I got to see the cherry blossoms at the weekend, and also, yeah, I'm not a J1 goalkeeper, so yeah, we've reasons to be positive. How about yourself, Ben?
I'm going well. Yes, the cherry blossoms in full bloom around here as well. A lovely time of year, and yeah, was able to get out with the family over the weekend, as well as watching some J1 action. That's, of course, what we're here to discuss on this podcast. And our guest this week is the Japan Times best-selling author of Between the Lines, Navigating the World of Japanese Football. And he's fresh off a jaunt down to Kyushu, during which he took in games from all three divisions of the J-League, maybe thrashing out the first few chapters of his next smash hit. It's a big welcome back to the pod to Sean Carroll. How are you, mate?
Did you say smash hit, or were you... Were you pushing those two words together then?
No, most definitely. Smash it, Sean.
I'm doing okay, thanks, mate. And yeah, no, that's it for me. No more books ever. I'm done. That's a one and done. Absolutely.
Thought maybe an anthology of short stories about the Seishin 18 Kippu, Sean, that you're just back from.
Actually, yeah, that would be quite nice. Maybe. But yeah, definitely with football. When it comes to football, I think I'm done. But yeah, the antics of travelling around on the local rail, there's definitely some sights and some things pop up on the way around. So I highly recommend it to anyone who's got a bit of time and is not in a rush to get where they're going. As they say, it's all, you know, it's the journey rather than the destination, isn't it?
Absolutely. So I said you went down to Kyushu. Can we fill us in on the specifics? Where did you? Did you get down to Hiroshima and start from there, or what was the journey?
I'm not that young anymore, so I did do that. I did go all the way down from Tokyo down to Oita when I was a young strapping lad when I first moved here. But that's body isn't up for that anymore. So I flew down to Hiroshima on the Saturday. Just about made it to the stadium, the fantastic stadium they've got now for the game against Gamba. Because the airport is miles away. It took longer to get from the airport to the stadium than it took for me to get from Tokyo to Hiroshima. So I flew down, went to that game, that finished. And then once I was done with the mix zone there, I got a train down to Kokura in Kitakyushu. Well, yeah, Fukuoka Ken, Kitakyushu. Spent the night there, watched Giravans against Omiya the next day. Went and met a friend of the pod, Scott McIntyre, that evening in Hakata for a couple of drinks. Next morning, made my way over to Oita, a place called Saiki, where there's absolutely nothing. But I wanted to go to Kagoshima for the game on the Wednesday. And using this Seishin Jachi Kippu, you can only take local trains. You can't take any expresses or anything. So you couldn't do like Hakata, Fukuoka down to Kagoshima in one day. So stopped off one night in Oita, up at 6 the next morning to finish the journey. But again, because you can only take certain trains, it meant I got to somewhere called Miyakonojo in Miyazaki Prefecture. And I had to wait there 5 hours because the other trains that went on to Kagoshima were all rapids, which I wasn't allowed on that ticket. And you could pay, like you could just buy a ticket. It was probably about $2,000-$2,500 yen. So you can just, you know, buy a ticket to get these rapid trains. They're not stopping you getting on them. But it was like, you know, well, I'm here. I'm never going to come to this place again. I might as well have a wander around. So I found a park, had a bit of a nap. Again, showing my age. Just wandered around a bit. So saw the sights and then made my way down to Kagoshima on the, when was that? I would have got there like Tuesday off late afternoon, early evening. Went to the Kagoshima against Kofu game on the Wednesday. Surprised Peter Utaka in the mix zone because he wasn't really expecting many media to be down there, I don't think. And then I flew back from Kagoshima on Thursday morning up to Tokyo. So it was, sort of a six-ish days whirlwind trip. But yeah, lots of fun. And yeah, definitely recommend it. If you're, it might be a bit tricky for tourists if you don't speak any Japanese. Just working out the timetables and stuff might be a little bit problematic. Mm. And also, yeah, if you're a tourist and you've only got a certain amount of time, you can obviously get the JR pass and take Shinkansen, and it's far more efficient that way. But yeah, definitely, if you're sort of here studying for a few months, or if you live here and you're looking for something different to do, it's only 12,000 yen, and you get five days travel. So it's not like 5 days, like you don't start on the 10th and finish on the 15th. Like you can just use, like I used the first day back at the start of March, well, middle of March. I went to a game in Tochigi on the Saturday, came back to Tokyo after that, and then went up to Kashima on the Sunday. So you just get 5 days of travel within, it's just through the school holidays. So I think they do it 3 or 4 times a year.
Right.
So yeah, I highly recommend it to people that are looking to do something a bit slower. And yeah, take in the sights of, yeah, those sort of, I guess in America they call them sort of the flyover states, but yeah, the bits of Japan that, you know, maybe don't get a huge amount of tourists, because yeah, there's always stuff to see and people to meet. So yeah, highly recommend it.
Absolutely. And speaking of highly recommending things, Johnny, I know you did read Sean's book on your way back to the UK. And
we found him. We found the person who read it.
And you really and you enjoyed it, Johnny.
Yes, yes. I even got a signed copy from Sean. He was very kind to sign it for me. And yeah, I read it on the plane and a bit of my time when I was in Scotland. And yeah, I found it really interesting, not just from a like footballing perspective, but also as someone who's lived in Japan for many years. I mean, you can tend to think of like, you know, football being completely separate from your life. But you know, it's the way some of the players talked about their experiences working for essentially a Japanese like football club, like a Japanese company, was actually very, very similar to like what I felt. I think there was one, I think you interviewed, is it Calvin Jongapin? He used to play for Yokohama FC in Machida. And what he was talking about, like what he was expected to be as a foreign player and what he was not expected to be. I think that anyone who's ever worked in an Eikaiwa or that kind of environment, I think can really kind of connect with what he was saying there. It was very similar. So yeah, it was a lot of a lot of interesting information, a very good read. And yeah, I'd highly recommend it to any listener who hasn't already read it. I mean, Sean, if someone is wanting to buy the book, or how can they get in touch with you about doing that?
Yeah, they can get in touch with me through Twitter. Mm-hmm. And if they want a paper copy, a paperback hard copy, I've still got around 30 or 40. Or if they're youngsters who don't deal with paper, they can get it. I think Apple Books, Google Play, I think it's called, and on Kindle as well. They can pick up ebook copies of that. So yeah, but no, I'm really pleased to hear you enjoyed it, mate. That was kind of what I wanted it to be as well. I didn't want it to be, there was two things I wanted to avoid basically. I didn't want to do the kind of wacky Japan thing of like, oh, isn't Japan weird, don't they do things strangely, because I just think it just doesn't interest me at all. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think it was really, yeah, I don't really think these days it's actually particularly truthful to what it's like over here. And I didn't want it to just be about football, about how this team was good and why were they good and sort of tactical stuff. And I wanted it to be more looking at the culture of football and, yeah, like how it reflects Japanese culture. I wanted it to be, you know, that's, I think, football all over the world. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. It reflects the culture in which it's played. So I was hoping that would come across, which is why in the end I sort of structured it around an awful lot of interviews rather than just being my opinions, because I felt like, well, these are just my opinions and, you know, they don't necessarily, you get it the other way around. Again, as a foreigner living here, you'll express an opinion and Japanese people will then say, oh, is that what people in England think? And you kind of go, well, no, it's what I think. But there's like 65 million other people there who all think different things. And I was kind of hesitant because the book was essentially, it was written for a Japanese audience. It was published in Japanese. And then people asked once they saw that was out, if there was going to be an English version. So I, you know, did my best to make one available for those people who wanted one. But it was written for a Japanese audience, so I was sort of wary of doing that and just throwing out my opinion. So I wanted to speak to people, and people like Calvin, who had been here for a while. So, you know, if you just speak to someone who's only been here for 6 months or a year, I think you're only going to get the kind of quite surfacey things, because they're not going to probably have such a deep understanding of how things work here. And maybe they'll be a bit more hesitant to talk about things as well, or say critical things. Whereas someone like Calvin, Jay Bothroyd as well, was obviously characteristically forthright in his opinions. Ranko Popovic was excellent too. These people that have been here for several years and understand more about how things work. And it was really interesting too, actually, because they were some of the guys who, when I was sort of checking the final drafts with them and making sure I'd not taken anything out of context or not misrepresented them, it was the people who'd been here longer that were much more, how can I put it, not nervous, but careful about how things were said. They were kind of, they would come back with small things and say, oh, you know, this bit maybe doesn't sound quite right. I don't want it to seem like I'm suggesting this, or I don't want this to be offensive, which I was quite pleased about, because again, I didn't want to self-censor myself too much, because that was a topic I touched upon with how the Japanese media works within the book. So I was cautious of not doing that myself, but at the same time, I didn't want to criticize for the sake of criticizing, or be too sort of go too overboard, because I feel like it's always, how can I put it, these days with the way media works, with needing clicks and things, you have to be one way or the other. You have to be all in for something or against it. And personally, that isn't sort of how I approach discussions or topics anyway. I think there's always a line to be trod. So I was quite pleased that a lot of the interviewees were keen to kind of go the same way. So yeah, I'm pleased to hear that you enjoyed those aspects of it too, and that Calvin's comments were interesting, because everyone says this whenever they write a book, you know, you don't have to be interested in this topic to like this book, because that's what publishers want you to say. But I did kind of want it to be, you know, it could appeal to people who have an interest in Japan, or who, like you said, work in Japan but not in the football industry, to kind of pick up things of like, oh yeah, you know, that also happens here. Becca Moros, the American player that I spoke to as well, I found her interview really, really interesting, because she was talking about a lot of those aspects of always feeling like being a foreigner, and not really, even though people are very nice, you never really feel like you're fully sort of ingratiated into the culture, and those kind of aspects. I thought, well, yeah, this is something that, you know, I've heard people, you know, friends who don't have any interest or involvement in football talk about in their fields too. So yeah, that was basically it. But it was a hell of a lot of work. And looking back now, it was, yeah, an incredibly wide sort of, I didn't just focus on one topic. I tried to cover quite a lot of different topics, which made it obviously a lot more work to research those specific topics, but then trying to kind of keep each of them sort of concise enough that you didn't bang on too long, but also not sort of not graze over them too lightly. It was quite tough getting that balance. But yeah, I haven't looked at the book since I sent the final proofs over to be printed. I haven't looked at it, and I don't plan on reading the thing for a good decade. Yeah, I'm done with it. So how's that for a sales pitch? I don't want to read it again, but please grab a copy and read it for yourself, and let me know what you think.
That's it. Everybody else read it, so Sean doesn't have to anymore.
Please.
Yeah, so it's Between the Lines, Navigating the World of Japanese Football. And again, you can head to Sean's Twitter, Sean Karuru, and yes, it's his pinned tweet, and you can get the information on how you can get your hands on a copy of the book. All right, yeah, tremendous work, Sean, from both myself And Johnny, well done, mate. All right, then. So, yeah, since our last episode, two rounds of J1 action took place last midweek. Match day 6 was played, and then over the weekend, match day 7, which is natural as it follows on from 6. So we're going to focus on the weekend primarily, but, some talking points from Wednesday as well, as we tried to summarise two rounds of games, during which only three teams won twice. One of those we might have expected, Hiroshima, who headed to leaders Machida on Wednesday night and handed them their first defeat of the season, a 2-1 at the Gion Stadium, before beating 10-man Shonan 2-0 at home on Sunday, with the ex-Belmare striker Yuki Ohashi following on from scoring at both ends against Zelvia, getting both goals. And two teams that most of us would not have had on our bingo cards for winning twice in the last two match days. It promoted Iwata, downed Niigata 2-0 at home in the week, thanks to a quick fire second half brace from runaway Golden Boot leader Rio Germain, before stunning Kyoto 3-0 away on Sunday, with the new Brazilian striker Matheus Peixoto doubling up with a second half brace of his own. And it should have really been a hat trick, as he had a penalty saved just before half time. The other team that won twice was the FC Tokyo, who took 6 points from their national stadium doubleheader. They fought back against Urawa on Wednesday after having an early Takahiro Koh goal VAR'd off, and then conceded the clubhouse leader for goal of the season from the halfway line in the first half by Thiago Santana. But Tokyo fought back in a stirring second half display, capped by terrific strikes by Ryotaro Araki and Kuryu Matsuki. And then on Sunday, second half goals from Teruhito Nakagawa and Riki Harakawa led them to a 2-0 win over Kashima. So we'll get Sean's thoughts on Hiroshima as well, Johnny. But yeah, just wrapping up their couple of games. Obviously, a huge one away at Machida in the week. And then, an emotional one, I'm sure, for Yuki Ohashi coming up against Shonan. But he did the business.
Yeah, I think a bit like Sean, I mostly kind of relied on highlights for the midweek action. And then I saw quite a lot of kind of live stuff on the weekend. And I think for Hiroshima, what we mentioned last week, it was a pretty tough week, because the game against Gamba was quite... might not seem that tough before kickoff, but I think it was quite a physically challenging game. And then having to go to Machida, who are obviously top, and then getting the win. And Machida were still top after Hiroshima went there and toppled them. But I think, you might have thought it might have dented Machida's confidence slightly, but it didn't really seem to. But for Hiroshima, I think to go there and kind of boss that game and get the win, I think that'd be a big kind of big boost for them. Even if they did lose a Araki at the back, he seems to have picked up some kind of injury, and then Nakano's gone in there, and I believe that is Nakano's real position. He's basically a centre back who can play at wing back. So now they've got Arai there, they've got Nakano's in at centre back, and I'm not sure how long Araki will be out for. And then, this game I wrote down, according to the stats I saw, took 29 shots to 6 for Hiroshima. But, maybe after the kind of couple of games they've had, it wasn't all plain sailing. And, I didn't actually realise until I heard from the commentators that Kato and Ohashi played together at Chuo University. I think Ohashi's a year older. So if I'd known that last winter, I could probably have guessed that Ohashi was going to Hiroshima when we were trying to find a club for him. But they're obviously linking up well. That's a bit of a hotline already, and it seems like anything they do kind of position wise or kind of personnel wise, it seems to turn to gold for Hiroshima. So I picked them as my champions this year, and it's very early days, but I think that they're off to a decent start, that they're looking good, and they've still got some players to come back from injury. I think the only kind of thing I wanted to ask about this game, I'm not a refereeing expert, but I thought, the Song Boom Koon was obviously one of three goalkeepers to be red carded the second match day, and he got a straight red for giving away a penalty. Is that a penalty because it was like Dogzo, what would be like ultra Dogzo, like handballing the ball on the line? Is that why he got the red card? Does anyone know?
Well, there was a little bit of chat about this in our line group, Johnny, and I think for it to be a penalty and a red card, I think the referee has to consider it serious foul play, doesn't he? So, whether it actually was that or not, I think is very debatable, but Yeah, for me, it was a strange one to get the triple jeopardy, whatever they were calling it. So yeah, that was a head scratcher for me. I'm guessing you might not have seen that incident, Sean, to have an opinion on it.
I only saw the highlights, so I don't know. I don't know for sure. Yeah, I thought as well that they'd taken away that if you gave away a penalty, it couldn't be a red, but you only get the one. So I'm not 100%. You'll have to we'll have to start paging Alan Gibson and find out what the rule is.
The other thing was, because in the Vissel Mariners game, that they checked because it was right on the line. So if it was in the box, it was a penalty, and Mayakawa would have got a yellow card, but it was just outside, so he got a red card, which made me think it was a bit odd that Song gave away a penalty and got a red card. But
Yeah, definitely a strange one. Yeah, so Sean, you saw Hiroshima Gumby, you said, at the start of your journey. So what did you make of them on that afternoon? And in the season to this point, because, yeah, Johnny had them for the title, so did I. So I think a number of people did. How impressed or otherwise have you been with them so far?
The thing I've found most impressive about them is they look like a team that knows what they're doing. Like, everyone is on the same page. They look confident. They look assured. They're really physical. For a J-League team, every player looks like combative. They look strong in the challenge. They don't shy away from things. And they just look, incredibly well organized, full of belief. They should have taken the lead. They should have been ahead in that game against Gamba. And then they kind of suffered the sucker punch of going behind, and it looked like, how are they going to deal with this? And they didn't panic. Okay, the equaliser was that phenomenal goal from your debutant right back with a left footer from 30 yards, whatever it was. So you're not going to get them every week. But even so, the fact that they didn't waver, stuck to what they were doing, got the goal back. And I watched their game before I went to the Tokyo game yesterday against Kashima. I watched their game against Shonan, and they just look so composed. They just look so like aware of what they need to be doing, how they need to be doing it. Obviously that's now shown in their results, because they are they're going so strong. They've even managed to beat Machida Zelvia, which is now the mark of a true champion team, evidently. It's a long, long season, as you said. Once injuries creep in, when they do suffer a defeat, how do they react to it? With the rest of the league looking so open, if they can just keep soldiering on and play in the same way and stick with that belief. I noticed as well that Michael Skibbe seems to do a team talk on the pitch. Mm. I think he does it after every game, or he did it after the Gamba game, and I noticed they were doing something similar after the Shonan game yesterday too. So I wonder what that's about, if he likes to give the players sort of instant feedback, if there's something, some reason that he does that, because it doesn't seem to be especially common. You don't see many teams doing that. I don't necessarily think that's a key to their success, but yeah, there's just some kind of unity amongst the team at the minute that does look very impressive from the outside looking in.
Yes, indeed, most definitely. So a terrific week for Hiroshima, no question, with Ohashi getting three goals into the opponent's net and one into his own against Machida. It was a terrific header, it must be said. Yeah, unfortunately, into his own goal. But he's prolific at the start of his Hiroshima career. So what about the other two teams that won twice then? Johnny, we'll start with Iwata, who, they've stunned a lot of us with the way they've gone about things in the past week or so, beating Niigata, and then, a terrific win away at Kyoto, despite Sanga having a number of chances, it must be said, in the first half. But, after Peixoto's penalty was a save just before the break, they went and properly put their foot down against Sanga in the second half. And you see Jubilo all the way up in 11th. I think that might take a bit of getting used to.
Yeah, I think Jubilo seem like a very, very streaky team. Either everything they hit goes in the back of the net, or they look like they're going to score in every attack, or you have other days where it just looks like they could play for hours and hours and not get a goal. And I know when we had Scott on, he mentioned about Niigata's rotation and that they rotated, I think, all 10 outfield players. They changed for the game against Jubilo. So, they were rightly dispatched 2-0 there by Jubilo, took advantage of that. And then, like you say, I think this seemed like quite an even game up until Jubilo took the lead. And yeah, they missed a penalty, but it was one of those rubbish ones where someone gets hit in the hand from about 2 centimetres away. And then I think as a neutral, you're quite happy to see them get missed. It was a good save by Gu. And then, yeah, the second half, I think, you know, Choki J, he won't be happy at all. As usual, Hisashi Apiatawia, he looked great against Gamba, as he always does, and then went back to being a bomb scare again at the back. And then I guess three goals conceded, I think, all from either a corner or crosses from the right-hand side. Nishikubo, he was in for his first start, got one goal, one assist, a fantastic header to open the scoring. And I think it's quite important for them. Pippi Shoto got two goals, especially after missing the penalty, because, you know, as Sean pointed out after the round one, Rio Germain's not exactly known for his goal scoring prowess in J1. So although I think he's 7 from 7 now, I mean, the way he's performed in the past, there's no guarantee he won't finish up the season with just like 8 or 9 goals. So I think he definitely needs some support from Peixoto and others in the team if Jubilo are to maintain a position somewhere like 11th. I mean, whether they finish that high, it remains to be seen. But they've been competitive. I think the first week they were completely outplayed by Wiesel, but every other game they've been competitive in, which is a great sign. And they've got, you know, got a decent enough squad. So I think if they can keep the players mostly fit and they do find a kind of source of goals, if it is Germain continuing to score, or if it's Peixoto or some of the midfielders coming to the party, then, yeah, they could avoid the bottom three. But, yeah, a fantastic week for them, yeah.
Absolutely. And this might be a good point to bring in one of Sam Robson's questions, and I'll throw it to you first, Sean. By the way, check our line chat, because a late question's come in from Craig, and don't worry, Craig, we'll get it answered for you. Just this one time, we'll let you off with being a little bit late. Yes, Sam asks, Sean, it's only been a handful of games, he realises, and he hasn't been able to watch as much as he'd want to, but he says the gap in quality between top and bottom appears to be a lot closer than it's been in a while. Would you agree with that? And if so, is that an overall good thing for the league? So, yeah, I mean, a team like Iwata, who I think almost everybody would have had in their bottom three at the start of the season in their J-Preds. And, of course, there's plenty of time for them to slip back down the table, and they might ultimately end up getting relegated again. But, yeah, a couple of results like this in quick succession will give them belief that, they're not just here to make up the numbers. So have you noticed that in the early going? I mean, a perfect example is Machida being top, but, a team like Iwata comfortably in mid-table at the moment, does that add more fuel to Sam's argument there, do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think there is, obviously, there's been so many, I don't know if you can call them surprise results anymore, but yeah, like, you know, Kyoto beat Kawasaki, Avispa beat Marinos, as you said, Jubilo as well, beating Kawasaki, winning at the weekend against away at Kyoto, who beat Kawasaki. Kawasaki beat Tokyo, then Tokyo managed to win against Reds and Kashima. Kashima also beat Kawasaki. It's like, you know, there's no real, like, you just go around and it's like, okay, they're the best team. Oh, no, hang on, they lost to them. Okay, well, they lost to them, so they should beat them. And then it doesn't quite work out. Personally, I like it. I'm a fan of football from a sporting point of view. So I like the fact that it's a competition that you don't necessarily know on any one day. I don't find many things more boring than the Premier League or the Champions League, where it's just like, well, this team's got the most money and they're stockpiling the best players, so they're going to eventually get through and win or whatever. I find that incredibly boring. Whereas with the J League, yeah, you just really don't know any game you go to, pretty much. I mean, you know, Sagan Tosu have been pretty poor this year. They drew with Vissel the other day, 0-0 as well. It wasn't 4-4. It was 0-0. So I like it. I think it's good. I'm definitely against this, the idea that apparently was being floated by the J League to try and establish one or two sort of big clubs, for want of a better phrase. I think it's that sport should be about competition. It should be about level playing fields, you know, as much as you can have in a professional sporting environment. I think it's it should be about getting the right coach in who's able to get the group all reading from the same script, working together, players, you know, you had it so many times over the years. I mean, if you think about not in the J League, but there was that Ajax team from a few years ago that got all the way, I think, was it the Champions League semi-final they got to in the end? Was that where they lost to Spurs?
I think so.
You get these teams, yeah, that come through where you just get, and then very few of those players, once they moved on to sort of air quotes bigger clubs, essentially just for more money, they didn't really kick on another level and become the best player in the world. Donny van der Beek went to Man United, didn't really do much, for example. So there's something about the right players together at the right time under the right coach, to bring it back to the J League, Rawaso Kumamoto a couple of years ago. You know, Toshiki Takahashi's just gone from Urawa on loan to Yokohama FC. I think Yokohama FC bought one of those players from Rawaso, or signed them.
Sakamoto,
right? Yeah. And then he didn't do much. Now he's on the bench at Montedio Yamagata, where Sugiyama, who was also at Rawaso Kumamoto during that good year, and then he went to somewhere else. Where did he go? He went to Gamba. And now, yeah, he's also at Montedio now. And you just think, I wonder what would have happened. Obviously, Sol Kawahara maybe is the one that you could possibly argue is, you know, stands out in that, because he's done well, albeit, you know, playing for not one of the best teams in J1. But he's become a regular at Sagan Tosu. But you just wonder, if they could have kept those players together under that coach, maybe they could have got promoted last year. Maybe they could have been doing probably not what Machida are doing now, realistically, but they could now be up in J1 with that collective of players. And you just, it's kind of a shame that the money side of it always comes in, that whether it's pressure just they put players put on themselves, whether it's pressure from agents or whatever to jump at the first chance to, you know, to go to a bigger club for a bit more money. You just think, from a sporting point of view, it would be great if these teams stayed together. So the fact that the J1, and I mean J2 is the same now, but we're veering off into JTET territory there, so I won't do that. But yeah, I personally I like it. I think it's great, because that's what sport should be about.
Yeah, I really agree with what Sean said there, and I must admit, I was slightly worried when it went back, the J1 went back to 20 teams, because I think if you remember back in 2021, which was still a bit of a crazy year because we were still in COVID, that there was a bit of a gap. There was about four or five teams that were pretty poor by J1 standards, but kind of looking back, that might have been connected to, like, you mean, the 2020 season and the loss of revenue and all that. So, and the fact we've got these kind of three teams, Machida are obviously quite heavily backed financially. Jubilo have a big history in J1, and, you know, Verdi haven't been in J1 for a while, but they're obviously a big famous name in J League circles. So it's definitely helped the competitiveness. I mean, Sean's mentioned that Sagan Tosu. I mean, we'll come on to them later, but they look like they might be in a bit of trouble. And I mean, you could argue, I mean, last season, like, statistically, they were the worst team in the league, but they managed to kind of pull off a few results. But other than that, I mean, even, yeah, Sapporo, as well, again, we'll come on to soon, that they've looked quite competitive in their last couple of games, that like they might turn the corner. It's maybe just at the other end that, you know, people who got into J League recently, you'll remember the Kawasaki team that just bulldozed the league in like 2020 and 2021. But, you know, as we know, that's not really what happens most of the time. It's usually a tight race. Quite often, one team is kind of leading into summer and then falls away through the autumn, and another team kind of comes charging through, as I think Sean mentioned in his book, is in one of the chapters about teams falling away towards the end of the season being part of Japanese culture. So it's something I think we all love. And I think, you know, if you are a fan of the J League, I don't speak for everyone, but I think there's a good chance that, you know, as we've said, you might kind of get a bit fed up with the same teams like winning the league year after year. I'm not going to mention the two teams from my home country. I don't want to go off too much in offending people. But yeah, there's a difference in J League to what happens in a lot of big, like, European leagues. And yeah, I'm all I'm all for that. So yeah, it's a really good, really interesting question from Sam. So thank you very much. So as Ben mentioned before, you know, San Francisco, Hiroshima, and Jubilo Iwata, they won their last two games, and the other team that won their last two games was Ben's FC Tokyo. We were kind of downbeat on them last week after getting a bit of a hammering at Kawasaki in the Tamagawa Classico, but you know, two games at the National Stadium may have been the turning point of FC Tokyo's season. So how are you feeling about things now, Ben, after the week FC Tokyo have had?
Well, yeah, still scratching my head, Johnny, as to what happened in the Classico. But, it can't be denied that they turned it on in these two showpiece occasions at the National Stadium. And, yeah, I guess we saw, once again, the Jekyll and Hyde Tokyo. But I need to check. Hyde is the good one, right?
Sean?
Not a clue.
I think Hyde's the good one, but actually we need Jekyll Tokyo. We need Tokyo a bit angry and a bit fired up and a bit evil, because they really got at Urawa on Wednesday night, and it was amazing to watch. But again, it had me and my mate Graham just wondering how they could have been so flat on the Saturday before. But it was a terrific occasion. Great to be there. My first experience of the new National Stadium, and thoroughly enjoyed it. The weather didn't cooperate, but I guess it all added to the occasion. And Tokyo went a goal down to an absolutely stunning strike from the halfway line by Thiago Santana, but they carried on and they got their rewards for a terrific second half display with these goals from Araki and Matsuki. And then on Sunday against Kashima, which I'm sure Sean can speak to as well, it was the first half especially for me was Kashima's greatest hits. They were they were falling on the floor. They were getting at the referee. They were getting all the decisions from the referee. It was like they'd rolled back the years. But while Tokyo were a little bit flat, they were never out of the game. And once the Kashima kind of blew themselves out in the second half, and it was up to the smallest man on the pitch, Terohito Nakagawa, to head them in front. And from there, they were able to see things out fairly comfortably before Riki Harakawa's icing on the cake. So what did you make of Tokyo on Sunday, Sean?
I thought they were all right. I didn't think either team played especially well. I didn't think either team played especially badly either. I mean, both managers afterwards talked about how good a game it was. They were full of praise for the opponent, and I thought it was they were slightly over egging the pudding. I didn't think it was an especially good game, but obviously they'd played three games in a week, two of the better teams in J1. So, you know, it's always going to be a reasonably tight contest. I thought the difference ultimately between the two was that Tokyo are set up, obviously under Pete Klimovsky, to play possession football, to be able to create chances off their own bat, not necessarily play on the counter, but to be able to break down opponents and do stuff when they're in possession. And I think the issue that Kashima have is that they, at the moment, are not able to do that. So although they did have quite a bit of possession, it was pretty neutral. They looked like they didn't really have any ideas as to how to make stuff happen when they had the ball. It was just a lot of hopeful punts into the area, crosses into the box, set piece delivery, and they were pretty woeful. Their delivery was very, very bad. They don't have really a sort of a creative player in the middle. Obviously, Gaku Shibasaki's come back and is injured. They're playing Kei Chinen, who is an average J-League striker who's been playing in a sort of deeper sort of central midfield role, which is obviously the first time he's done that, and he's doing a solid job there, but he's not going to be sort of creating stuff going forward. Kaishu Sano is another player I like, but again, he's not that type of player. Kashima looked really good a few games ago against Kawasaki, because you know Kawasaki are the team that want to have the ball, move it around, and then you can counter against them, and they did that really well. Against Tokyo, it was more of a 50-50. Both teams were kind of trying to do the same things. And I think Tokyo were just better equipped to make stuff happen when they had the ball. And yeah, you know, when you've got 161 centimeter Nakagawa scoring a header against you, I think if he hadn't scored then, you could see the game maybe petering out as a 0-0. I don't think either team really threatened that much going forward. But once Tokyo got that goal, it did look like, well, that's it. Kashima just don't have enough ideas or quality in the final third when it comes to kind of creating stuff. But I thought Tokyo, yeah, you know, they came from behind to win against Reds. They dealt well with Kashima, who have not been especially great after they beat Kawasaki. I think they just about managed to beat Jubilo and then obviously lost to Avispa. So it was something that, yeah, maybe in recent years, Tokyo, that's the kind of game that Tokyo would have drawn or maybe lost 1-0. So it's maybe a positive for them. But as we touched upon before, you know, in the J League now, you can't really, it's hard not to have recency bias, but you can't really get too carried away with the last result or the last couple of results, because, you know, the next banana skin is lying just around the corner.
Yeah, I reckon the next banana skin is lying around the corner in the Tokyo Derby on the weekend. So yeah, we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see about that, and we'll come on to Tokyo Verde very shortly. But before we leave these two teams from Sunday, Johnny, let's get Spencer's question answered. Spencer's our newest patron, so welcome aboard, Spencer. Was planning to give you a shout out at the end of the episode and then received your question, so we can give you your mention now. Spencer wonders, where do you see Kashima finishing after this start to the season? For him, it feels like another fourth to sixth place finish to him. It just seems like they have a glass ceiling right now, and I guess, yeah, it's kind of two steps forward, one step back for Antlers so far this season. And yeah, two defeats over the course of the last week hasn't done their cause of moving up the table any good.
Yeah, I know I said in pre-season I thought they'd be like Popovic, they'd either be like down in the bottom half and you get fired, or they'd be up challenging. But actually, in reality, it's looking like it will be the regular season of threatening to finish eighth or ninth, but actually ending up in fifth again. Just to kind of like piggyback on what Sean was saying there, I know it's just about Kashima. You know, they changed their manager, it seems like almost every year. And I know that like certain like big clubs where they have like directors of football and all these things, it's kind of seen as like, well, we can the manager's interchangeable. As long as the other people around there are there, we can keep playing our type of football. But at Kashima, you know, as Sean just kind of laid out, the type of football they're playing is not really particularly effective. And one thing that stood out to me, and I'm sorry for shoving a Gambo Osaka reference in here, but this game was actually eerily similar to a game, I think it was in 2020, Kashima lost 2-0 away to Gamba. And again, they played the first half quite well and ended up losing 2-0 with a goal right at the end, making it look a bit more comfortable than it was. But what I'd focus on was the subs. Like, they made exactly the same like mistakes on Sunday as they did like 4 years ago. In terms of when Kashima bring the subs on, it's usually not just like right winger replaces right winger. It's like bring on two players and then someone else has to move from like right wing to left wing, and then someone's from attacking midfield to central midfield. And then 10 minutes later, they bring on another three subs and there's more people moving around. And it just seems to like disrupt their rhythm more than it confuses the opposition. And they were already kind of getting like desperate. Like, if they don't get a goal within the first hour, it just ends up to let long hoofs into the box. And I think at the end of this game, they had like three wingers on, and Paredi was a sort of like notional like attacking midfielder, but he was basically on to just hit free kicks and sort of support hitting crosses in. So yeah, it's just the longer the game went on, the more kind of ragged they got, and the more obvious it became like what they were going to try and do. And then, so I mean, FC Tokyo second wasn't inevitable, but you could just kind of feel Kashima were losing hope more and more, and then FC Tokyo sort of gained from that and went up and showed them how to do it. So, I mean, yeah, they'll probably be somewhere in the top six this year. But, yeah, if I was an Atlas supporter, I'd be a bit worried about it. It just seems like history is repeating itself and they're going round and round making the same mistakes, playing the same style of football and not really getting close to being back at the summit of Japanese football.
Yep, absolutely. All right, thanks, Johnny. And yeah, two terrific crowds at the National Stadium for the two FC Tokyo home games. 49,005 in the rain on the Wednesday night. I was five off guessing the exact crowd number. Me and my mate Graham always do a guess the crowd when we're at a game together. It was our first experience of the National Stadium, the pair of us. He went first and said 55,000. Obviously, I had no idea, but I didn't think it was that high. So I said 49,000, and when it flashed up on the screen, couldn't quite believe it, 49,005. So, closest
Ben,
to the
pin. Has anyone ever met your mate Graham, or is this like a Jekyll and Hyde thing? Because you always say my mate Graham.
And Scott definitely has, and Thomas and Alex, the other FC Tokyo guys, have as well, and Dan, of course, as well. So, yeah, don't worry, he's a real person, not my imaginary friend. And he'll be having a great laugh listening to this. By the way, and 52,000 on the Sunday in the nice weather. So yeah, two terrific crowds for Tokyo. Let's move on to two teams who won for the first time this season in the past week. Although this won't be very pleasant for Johnny to chat about. Sapporo. They were the only other team to play a doubleheader of home games, and after they lost in the 90th minute against Nagoya in midweek, they finally broke through for a first win of the season in the only game from match day 7 that was played on Saturday against the Gunma Osaka side that showed 7 changes from the midweek goalless draw at home against Kyoto. So Johnny, Gunma were obviously at a disadvantage as the only team to travel with a short turnaround between midweek and weekend. But yeah, we often talk about the number of players at Danny Poyatos's disposal. Saying that, though, were you surprised at the number of changes he made for this game?
Not really. I think if I can come back to that in just a second, because I don't know if I could maybe blame Sean for this, because the J League, the English YouTube channel was, or the official English account was putting out like Sapporo haven't won, Gamba haven't lost. So as soon as they did that, you knew exactly what was going to happen in this game. But yeah, I think Gamba and Sapporo, you know, they came into this in kind of different mindsets. I think, yeah, you know, as we kind of mentioned before, when there is a full midweek round, I think in all levels, J1, J2, J3, you often see quite a few games in the third round of the week are not really of particularly high standard. And I mean, if I'm honest, this was a bit of a turd of a game. And I promise I'm not saying that just because it was my team that lost. Gamba and Sapporo, they both finished playing at 9 o'clock on Wednesday night, and then having to do it again at 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. And I do have utmost sympathy for anyone trying to make the J League schedule with all the kind of external factors about. But you know, this was kind of the poor third round of the week game on steroids, because you know, Gamba mass changes, because not only do they have a midweek game like last week, they're playing Marinos on Wednesday, and then they're at Sagantosu on Sunday. So they've had this bizarre start to the season where they had made 3 games in the first 5 weeks, and now they've got 5 in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we're just unlucky or we're doing something wrong, but we seem to have a ton of injuries, especially on both wings and at fullback. And there's players coming back, and I think Ryotaro Meshino's forgot how to play football when he was out. He was back, and Jabali was in. So yeah, a lot of changes, a lot of disruption. But yeah, Gamba do have a big, massive squad with a lot of like experienced players like Ishii and players like that came in. And Sapporo, the heartbreaking loss to Nagoya in midweek. And Petrovic is obviously worried about losing his job. So I think he only made 2 changes, one of which was Musashi Suzuki couldn't play because he's on loan from Gamba. So you have this kind of balance of one team is basically knackered and mentally shot, and the other one's second and third choices. So it wasn't the best of games. I think first half it was 2 free kicks. I think Yuki Kobayashi had a free kick saved by Ichimori, and then Jabali's obviously been practicing with Endo. He had a great free kick off the post. They need a shot cleared off the line early in the second half, and I think Sapporo, I think it was Baba and Takao fluffed a couple of headers before Miyazawa got the winner. I think from what I've seen, you know, Sapporo, they got smashed at Kobe last week, and they've bounced back. You know, they gave Nagoya a really good game. They've given Gamba a good game. I mean, you might say they haven't necessarily deserved to win either game, but they've not really deserved to lose. So maybe it's a start of something. So, I mean, I wanted to kind of bring Sean in here on the on Sapporo. What, where do you think with like Sapporo and Misha Petrovic, you know, these last two kind of performances, do you think after getting this result, they can maybe kick on and move up the table? Or do you think, you know, as welcome as these 3 points against Gamba are, is it really just kicking the can down the road a few weeks in regards to Misha Petrovic?
Yeah, I personally don't think they really should have stuck with him at the end of last season. I feel like nothing against him, probably nothing that hasn't been said before, but I feel like his time there has just run its course. I think it's, you know, you never want to, well, you do sometimes if you don't like a manager, but you usually don't want to call for a manager to be fired or whatever. But I just feel like everything seems to have grown quite stale there. You look at the lineup each week, it doesn't look especially exciting. A lot of the same old players are still there, and you just think, well, a lot of 5-6 out of 10 J League players, there's nothing really sort of to be hopeful about. So I don't really think, you know, I don't think the fact that they hadn't won necessarily means, well, you need to fire him because they're not winning. And I don't think, oh, because they've just won a game now, oh, okay, well, maybe things are picking up, maybe we should stick with him. I don't think it should be that sort of short-termist. You shouldn't just be looking at, again, for fear of sounding too much like Scott McIntyre, you don't necessarily need to be looking just at the results. You need to be looking at the bigger picture. And I just feel like, yeah, that his time has run its course. They obviously have the issue of, you know, three teams are relegated outright this year. So the longer the season goes on with them hanging around there, the more that, you know, the club will maybe start to get nervous and think, well, do we pull the trigger? But then who do you bring in? You know, is there anyone available who can come in and do something different with the players we've got? Because when you look at the squad, there isn't a huge amount of quality there. There's decent-ish players, but you look and you wonder where the goal is going to come from. Last year, Asano scored a lot, but he's, you know, there's a reason that Hiroshima let him go. He was decent. I think he was at Mito Hollyhock before he went to Hiroshima, yeah. And he was all right there. He looked, you know, like a tidy player, but you just wonder if, you know, if he's able to hit those heights again and be a consistent threat in the final third at that level again. So it's a tricky one, but yeah, I think there's. I was up in Sapporo for their last game of last season when it was Shinji Ono's send-off. Mm. And yeah, I mean, even that, it was a bit odd, you know, it's an official match and you're letting him start the game in a competitive game against a team that still had something to play for. As much of a legend as he is, as much of a nice guy as he is, you wonder how many other coaches would have allowed that to happen, or you know, sort of maybe push for that to happen. You know, Misha Petrovic as well is a very nice guy by all accounts. Whenever I've encountered him, he's always been very friendly too. And you never know if they do get rid of him. When Hiroshima got rid of him, the next year they won the league. I think after he left Reds, I've got a feeling, didn't they win the Champions League the following year? 2017? Did he leave in 16?
Rings a bell somewhere.
Yeah, you might be right, I think. Yeah, yeah.
So you never know. It could be a good move for Sapporo. Get rid of him. Promote whoever his assistant coach is.
Well, no, I know somebody who would manage them for free, Sean.
You do? Who's that?
You might have interviewed him for your book.
I might have interviewed him for my book. I'm going to guess it's not Javier Aguirre. So Jay Bothwell. Oh, well, there you go. That's it then. Yeah, get Jay in the hot seat and they'll win the league next year. Or maybe the Levan Cup.
He might even pull his boots back on and, give Masashi Suzuki some competition up front.
Player manager. And they could do the one of those shots like in the 90s when you had a player manager and he could have like he could have the suit and the tie on top and then the shorts and the socks and the boots on the bottom. And he could be eating some fish and chips for the photo shoot. Perfect.
There we go. We've sussed it. There we go. Absolutely. All right then. So, a much needed, to put it mildly, win for Sapporo to, hopefully kickstart their season. But yeah, they're still bottom of the table, goal difference behind Tosu after seven games. Also tasting victory for the first time this season were Tokyo Verde. It was in the Green Derby away at Shonan last Wednesday night, where the Tokyo Greens fell behind to a Lukian goal in the 15th minute. But 15 minutes from time, Hiroto Taniguchi drew them level with their penchant for late drama surfacing again with the 4 minutes left when Hiroto Yamami sealed a famous triumph, their first top flight win since 2008. And they were on course to make it two wins in a week after Fuki Yamada's 10th minute goal at home against Kashiwa on Sunday, only for Reysol sub Kosuke Kinoshita to make an instant impact off the bench, heading in the equaliser in the 73rd minute, just 2 minutes after coming on. So, yeah, Verde have been a story we've been following very closely on the pod in the early stages of this season. Sean, obviously a lot of, well, drama, late drama in all of their games to this point of the season. And, yeah, great for them to taste their first victory of the year, especially for me before the Tokyo Derby. It would have been very, very painful if that had been their first victory back in the top flight. But, yeah, just like Iwata, we can see Verde have, taken to life back in J1, like a duck to water. I don't know if that's the correct turn of phrase or not. But, yeah, they certainly have not seemed out of their depth at all, I think, in any of their games so far.
Yeah, I wouldn't be quite so enthusiastic personally. I think the issue that they've got is, yeah, they've started all right. They've looked a little bit naive, obviously, at times, certainly at the end of games on several occasions. But the fact that they've started quite well and are still only, 3 points above Sapporo, who started terribly, suggests that, I just wonder, as the season wears on, because what you need to do as a team when you come up is sort of hit the ground running and try and get over that hurdle of coming up a division, of settling in and establishing yourself as a team to be reckoned with in the first division as quick as possible. And although Verde maybe have done that in terms of the way they've played and the way they've kind of gone toe-to-toe in terms of on the pitch within individual games, points-wise, they've only won that one game. And you just wonder, as the season wears on, as teams that are more used to being in the first division, not only, you know, the likes of Reds, Nagoya, whatever, Marinos, Kashima, who've maybe not started as quickly as people would have thought, once they click into gear maybe later on in the season and are tougher opponents to face. And also once, you know, the likes of Tosu, Shonan, Kyoto, Albirex, maybe the teams that Verde are probably going to be vying with to stay up. Those teams have been there and done it countless times. They know what it takes to stay up. They're not going to be, they'll be feeling obviously a certain amount of pressure and nervousness, but they'd have done it before. They'll know how to cope with that. So you'd kind of hope that from the way Verde have played, if they could have picked up another win here or there just to kind of edge themselves a little bit further up, give themselves a bit of a buffer like Niigata did last year. Niigata started quite well, as I recall, and then they had a bit of a slump later on in the season, but they'd given themselves enough of a buffer to kind of be able to ride that out. I just wonder with Verde if they've just got quite enough. They've got a lot of decent players. They're going to lose one of their best players. Obviously, Fuki Yamada is going away for the under-23 Asian Cup, and he's looked very, very good for them, you know, in terms of creating stuff, making things happen. Without him, you just wonder if they've really got enough. Obviously, Somino, I think, is Somino go? No, Somino didn't make the squad, did he?
No, he didn't, no.
He didn't make the squad, okay. But even so, Somino is a bit hit and miss. I like him. He was very good for them last year in J2 when he came in and really sort of helped give them a slightly more of a goal threat. But I don't know at J1 if he's consistent enough, if he's going to get enough goals. So I think longer term, I still don't think they're going to be pushing on much higher than where they are now. I think they're going to be within touching distance of the relegation zone, because if you look at the teams around them, I mean, I know points now, it's all so bunched up, but when you look at the table and you see that, you know, Kawasaki, Albirex, Vispa, Gamba are the four sort of directly above them when you're within a point or two, you'd expect all of them to be kicking on and doing a bit better as the season goes on. So I think they're still going to be, I don't think they're definitely going to go down. But I'm not especially confident. So Verdi fans listening will be delighted to hear. I've probably jinxed them now, and they'll beat Tokyo 5-0 at the weekend.
watch out for Yamami. He scores nowhere near enough goals, but whenever he does, it's in a derby or it's like a late winner. So you definitely want to watch out for him.
Music to my ears, Johnny. All right, terrific stuff. All right then. Well, that's an interesting take from Sean, though, Johnny. I think, you know, we've been generally positive about them to this point, I guess because of, you know, the entertainment factor of their games, and they've, again, horrible cliche alert, their never say die attitude. They've either been leading or been fighting back in pretty much every game so far. But it's interesting to hear Sean's take there that the 7 points of their name, it's a point well made that despite the entertainment they've given us thus far, they're still only 3 points above the bottom place team.
Yeah, I think it's another really good point as well about the Yamada being away with the under 23s, because, you know, his goal against Kashiwa, I doubt there's another player in the Verdi team can score this, because it's, you know, it's a mistake by Diego. He comes up to the halfway line to try and win the clearance from Matthias and doesn't get there, but it is on the halfway line. It's not like he's made it on the 6-yard box. So Yamada's still got to, he puts the afterburners on, so he makes sure by the time Diego catches him, he's in the box. So then Diego knows he's behind him. He can't really block him or he's going to give away a penalty. I think I mentioned when we talked to Lewis in pre-season, Yamami has this awful tendency of just kind of running the wrong way when he gets a chance like that. And yeah, I don't really see a ton of like pace or that kind of level of clinicalness from his teammates. So it'll be very interesting to see how they get on without him in the team for kind of a month or so. Yeah, I think that they're definitely going to battle away, and I don't think there won't be like three teams cut adrift at the end of the season. But yeah, Verdi are definitely a very, very entertaining side to watch, and they've started, they've started better than I thought they might do. So yeah, I'll definitely be kind of keeping an eye on them. And just a quick word on Kashiwa, because that's 4-1-1 draws in the first 7 games, and it just feels like any time you watch Kashiwa, it's either 1-1 or it feels like 1-1 would have been a fair result. And they've got the two centre backs and the goalkeeper are pretty solid. They're not going to concede that many goals, and Hosoya and Savio keep any defence honest. And I feel like a broken record. They just sort of look the same level as their opponents. And yeah, they're going to miss Hosoya and Sekine, the under 23s. So very good for them that Kinoshita got a nice goal. I think that's 3 goals for him this season. But very powerful neck muscles to kind of get his neck around that and work that into the corner. And I think, Verdi took the lead, but Kashiwa kind of came on strong to the second half. And yeah, what 1-1 was a fair result. And yeah, Kashiwa, I don't really see being any kind of relegation trouble this year, and they're not going to challenge right at the top. But yeah, it's a decent enough game, and yeah, 1-1 for both these teams to round out the match week.
All right then, thanks, Johnny. So they are the three teams that won both of their games in the past week, and indeed Sapporo and Verdi winning for the first time this season. Let's move on and chat. Well, we've spoken at length about two of the promoted clubs thus far, and we mentioned that the third promoted club, Machida, lost for the first time at home against Hiroshima last Wednesday night. So it was interesting to see how they would bounce back away at Kawasaki on Sunday. Well, they bounced back with a 1-0 win at their near neighbours, despite playing the last 20 minutes with the 10 men after keeper Corsetani was sent off. Shota Fujio continued his brilliant start to the season with the only goal of the game just past the half hour. And yes, Azelvia hung on to the 3 points despite a bit of a barrage from the hosts, who failed to build on their 0-0 draw away at Yokohama F. Marinos in midweek, a game they finished with 10 men themselves. So yeah, it's I think it's gotten to the point with Frontale, Sean, where we're talking about them for negative, much more negative rather than positive reasons these days. Their slide down the table While I don't think it's terminal necessarily, it's not really that much of a surprise anymore. But yeah, Machida going top of the pile and staying there this far into the season has definitely turned some heads. You wrote about them recently. What have they done right, and what have they done that's impressed you thus far in this season?
What have they done right? They've won a lot of games.
Yeah,
that's what they've done.
To what you talked about with Hiroshima, with all of the players being that well drilled, they know exactly where they have to be and what the manager expects of them.
I think there's an element of that, and I think there's an element of they went down. You said there they went down to 10 men for the last 20 minutes, and I think they're one of those teams where you're like, they're probably even harder to play against once they go down to 10 men, because they're so confident in their ability to see out results. I remember I covered them a bit in J2 last year as well, and I asked the manager after in a press conference after I forget which game it was, to be honest, but it was probably about two-thirds of the way through the season, and I asked him, like, you know, did he feel that they'd obviously been doing well, they were top of the table, but was he concerned that as the pressure built and results, every result was going to matter towards the end of the season? Every result matters obviously throughout, but, you know, towards the end of the season, there's more pressure going into games. And he just was very, like, calm about it and just said, well, no, because, you know, we're confident that if it's 0-0, we know we can get that goal to win 1-0. If we're winning 1-0, we know that we can see out the result. We, you know, we have the belief in the squad. And it's always touch and go when a team gets promoted, if they're going to be able to do that in the first division. And they've done that. They're doing exactly the same thing. They're seeing out these results. I spoke to Nakagawa from Tokyo after yesterday's game, because they are playing against Machida after the Tokyo derby. They're playing against Machida, and I asked him, because obviously he used to play for Machida for a bit on loan, and I asked him what he thought about Machida, and, you know, how he, you know, if he's been surprised by them, and he said, yeah, a little bit, but they do all the things that they have to do. And they do it well. And then he said, in Japanese, he laughed and he said, it's maybe a rude way to say it, but he said, it's the way they play is mendokusai. Which I don't know how, in English, I guess you'd say like a pain in the ass to play against. Yeah. I guess is how you'd probably translate it directly. And he kind of laughed about it and said, I'm sort of praising them. I mean it in a positive way, in that they're so hard to play against because of that. And I think that's it. I think, yeah, I saw them against Gamba on the first day of the season. And yeah, they start games really quickly. They try to get a goal early on, and then they seem comfortable then once they're ahead that, well, they've got that lead. And whereas some teams, once they have a lead, as a Man United fan, I know that all too well lately. But, you know, once they have a lead, they don't look confident keeping it. Machida just looks so happy, whether they score in the first minute or the 80th, they seem like they can do it. They've recruited pretty well. I really like Drezovic, the guy they brought in at centre back. Just looks a really solid player, confident, good on and off the ball. And just hard working. How far that can take them, you don't know over the course of the season. You wonder if, because they are fairly one dimensional, although it's hard to play against, you know exactly what to expect against them. Maybe teams are going to start to, we saw it maybe with a bit with Corfu in the ACL as well, where maybe opponents were taking them a bit lightly. Maybe they thought, they got one result, but, you know, perhaps, you know, that's it. Their luck's going to run out. Maybe once the season wears on into the second half, teams are not going to be going, oh, well, it's just Machida, they'll be okay. They're going to be really working out how to counter the way they play and shut them down. So it will be interesting. I think, yeah, I'm ahead of the season. I said in my preview that so much depends on how well they started. If they got off to a bad start and didn't win for a few games, they might struggle. Obviously, they haven't done that. So I think they'll certainly, well, obviously, they're not going to be dragged down towards the relegation battle. But I do just wonder if they've got enough variety in the way they play to take them all the way to mount a real title challenge. But as you've said, there are, you know, the league is very open this year, and with other teams constantly taking points off each other, if they can keep soldiering through, if they can avoid losing back-to-back games and just make sure they're picking up points all the way through, they could do. But I just wonder, yeah, if they have, you know, you look at the squad and it's a lot of cast-offs from other J1 clubs, players who've been very good in J2 and moved on onto this level who are doing well. And yeah, as I said before, you know, it's always nice when you see a team of that is maybe worth more than the sum of its parts doing well. But I think that's probably, that's probably what they've had so far, is that, as you said, that's sort of they're a collective. They don't try to do something they're not able to. And so far, no one's really had any solutions to how to get past them, except for Hiroshima, who are maybe, you know, who are similarly, you know, in under the, what is it, their third, fourth year under Skibbe, pretty much same core of players. So, yeah, they're in a similar boat where they know what they're doing.
I think maybe a big challenge coming up for Machida, because I believe Hirakawa and Fujio, that they're both in the Japan under 23 squad, so that they'll be missing for the next few games. But you know, other players have missed out. Like, I think Vasquez played the first few games, then got injured, and then Fujimoto's come in. And I thought he was really good in this game against Kawasaki, because I think, you know, Ben and I have mentioned Hirakawa on a weekly basis. But he was kind of, I think, upstaged by Fujimoto, who got the assist for Fujio's goal. And I think a lot of the play, I mean, the first half hour was basically just Machida dominance. It was all in the Kawasaki half. And a lot of their play came down the left through Fujimoto. And yeah, I think it was only like after half an hour or so that Kawasaki got their first shot. And then if you kind of look at the stats at the end of the game, it looks like Kawasaki dominated. But then if you can break it down, like nearly like 80 or 90% of Kawasaki's shots came when it was 11 against 10. And a lot of these shots were actually just from the edge of the box or outside the box with Machida with loads of players back, which kind of brings me to a point, maybe a bit of controversy about the Dogzo red card, because, you know, looking back, little or no contact from Tani on Kobayashi, and it seemed from my viewing like at the time and watching back on the replay, like I don't really see that anything happened that would stop Kobayashi from just running on and tapping the ball into the empty net, or at worst kind of getting to the ball before Drezovic, who was getting back to win a penalty. And I think this is the second time I've seen it happen this season. I think it was Kyoto lost at home to Yokohama F. Marinos, and they were 3-2 down, and they lost 3-2, and Fukuda of Kyoto was charging through, and it looked like he just saw a leg and chose to fall over it rather than, well, I could run past him and just tap into an empty goal. So, I mean, I don't know if it was a, you know, as you've mentioned, Sean Machida, a very difficult team to play against. And you know, I've seen, I think last season, Gamba against Marinos twice in Urawa. All times they were drawing or behind against a team that didn't really have to score another goal. And it is really, really hard to break down 10 men when they don't have to go upfield and get a goal, as Kawasaki found here. So, I mean, I wondered, Sean, did you think, did Kobayashi, did he make a bit of a meal of it? Could he have gone on and scored? Or am I making a meal of it? Well, what was your kind of take on that situation?
It's a tricky one. Yeah, I saw the highlights. I watched it back. It did look like the touch was very slight, but obviously it's in that instant, you know, when you watch the replays back, when you see them in slow motion from different angles, whatever, the speed they're moving at and things, maybe the connection was enough to knock him off. And in that millisecond that he has to make the decision, perhaps he just thinks it's the keeper. He's come out. It's a red card. Maybe he thought he was inside the area. You know, it's easy when you're watching it and you see six different replays to think, well, why didn't he do this? Wasn't he aware of that? Maybe he can't see exactly where Drezovic is. Maybe he thinks he's not going to get there. Maybe there's so many factors that come into it. But I did think there wasn't much of a contact, personally. And yeah, obviously, again, in hindsight, you look at it and think, well, they only got a free kick. They didn't score the free kick. They lost the game. Could he have stayed on his feet, gone on, equalised? Okay. Tani wouldn't have got a red card, but maybe then 1-1 at home, the crowd get behind you. Machida maybe aren't used to being pulled back. Things have been going well for them. They just lost their first game against Hiroshima. They might start to get a little bit edgy. But it's so easy to look back on it after the event. I think he had a millisecond to either to make the decision, or, yeah, as I said, the speed that he was moving at and the contact was just enough to knock him off course. And before he could process all those thoughts and think what's the best situation, what's the best decision to make here, what's the best solution, he'd already found himself falling over, and that was that.
Indeed. All right, then. Thanks, guys. So, yes, at Machida, stay top of the pile. They have 16 points from 7 games. In second spot, we find Hiroshima a point behind Zelvia, and on the same number of points as Hiroshima are Cerezo Osaka after a 1-0 victory for them away at Niigata on Sunday. And Leo Ciara scored for the second time in the week when he headed in a Seiya Maikuma cross in the 69th minute for the only goal of this game. As yesterday's a one for the fourth time this season, they followed on from Wednesday's 1-1 draw at Kashiwa. Of course, it was 1-1 with Reysol involved. And yes, Cerezo, along with Hiroshima, the only two teams left unbeaten after 7 rounds of the season. Let's move on to the clash of last season's top two at the Noiviru Stadium. Kobe hosted Yokohama F. Marinos, and for the second straight year, the visitors won by the odd goal in this fixture. On this occasion, 2-1, Jan Mateus curling in the winner up and over Vissel's backup keeper, Shota Arai, in the 83rd minute, 8 minutes after Daya Maekawa was sent off for taking out Jan on the edge of the box. So, yes, Maekawa, the third goalkeeper in J1 to be shown a straight red card for Dogso in match day 7. Anderson Lopez had given F. Marinos the lead early in the second half before Taisei Miyashiro's equaliser in the 66th minute. So, yeah, last season's top two then, Sean. They are, Kobe fourth and F. Marinos seventh after 7 rounds. But, of course, F. Marinos have that game to make up against Gamba this midweek. So they could go above Vissel and into fourth if they win that on Wednesday night. But, what have you made of these two thus far? A bit of a championship hangover for Vissel, or are they still purring along fairly reasonably despite losing this game?
I think, yeah. I don't know if you can call it a bit of a hangover. I think the fact that the league is slightly more open this year, just in general. And obviously, when you look at the players that were standouts for Kobe last year, Osako, Sakai, Muto, Yamaguchi, they're not getting any younger. They're obviously, they're not past it by any means. But there was a slight wonder if that was maybe, their sort of peak. They've obviously bought, Miyashiro has done well, maybe better than many maybe thought. Since he came in, Ideguchi came in, who's a solid J League, a decent player, but not sort of set the world alight anywhere he's been beforehand. So I think, it's still so early. We're only 7 games in. I mean, I was looking at the table before we started to record, and I was thinking about, our teams that aren't doing well. I'd thought that Reds were probably my favourite, along with Hiroshima at the start of the season. I was thinking, but they've not started well. And then I was surprised to look at the table and see they're up in 5th. Marinos as well, I thought, started slowly. They're 7th, but they've obviously got that game in hand to come on Wednesday. If they win that, they'll move up to 4th. So it's so early in the season, and so many teams have been taking points off of each other that, nobody's sort of cut adrift yet. It's quite rare in the J League that a team does win by a huge margin. I mean, when Kawasaki did it a few years ago, it was a bit of a standout. So I don't really think there's any major cause for concern for Vissel. I think they've still got the core of a decent squad there. They've still got obviously a lot of very good players, and they've got that added bonus now of the experience of having won the league last year, of knowing what it takes once the pressure starts to build. I still see them. I thought they'd probably drop down a little bit. I thought they'd still be in the mix to win the title this year, but I think I maybe had them in the top 4, second, third, fourth. I didn't think they'd quite have enough to win back-to-back titles. And I think, so far, they've had a reasonable enough start. But, only winning 3 of their first 7 is maybe not what maybe the Vissel at the end of last season, you maybe wouldn't have expected it of them. So perhaps, maybe there is an element of a hangover of the fact that players as well, kind of feeling like, well, we won the league. Although ahead of the season, they were saying, you know, we're not thinking of ourselves as champions. We're going again as challengers, and all the usual stuff they say. They're still human, and there might be an element of, well, we've done it now. We did win the league, so we've proven it. We don't necessarily need to be pushing ourselves that extra 0.5% in every game. Whereas maybe someone like Hiroshima, who's gone close and finished runners up 2 years in a row, right? Third, 2 years in a row. Yeah. So maybe they have got that slight element of extra hunger of like, well, we need to push on. We've done that. Now we need to go on. And Kobe maybe in those kind of very, very sort of small aspects. But again, after only 7 games of how many are there now in the season? 38?
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many. You know, we'll be looking back when there's 7 games to play after 31 rounds and maybe going, God, do you remember when Machida were up at the top of the table? What was that all about? There's so, you know, things can change so quickly in the J League that, yeah, I certainly don't think in the same way that Machida fans shouldn't be getting too carried away about how on earth they're going to do an open bus tour around Machida, because just getting to and from the stadium was enough of a chore. Don't know how they're going to manage that. At the same time, I don't think Vissel or Reds or Nagoya or whatever need to be panicking too much just yet.
Yeah, I think that's another chapter for your next book, Sean, getting out of the Gion Stadium at Machida and, getting back to Surikawa Station at a decent hour. All right, then. So, yeah, it wasn't the best week for the defending champions, Vissel. They were coming in to this game against F. Marinos on the back of a frustrating goalless draw away at Tosu. Speaking of Sagan, yes, they endured a bit of a rough week themselves, especially there at Sunday afternoon. They rocked up to Saitama Stadium and we're on the end of a 3-0 defeat at the hands of Urawa, who shook off the disappointment of their midweek defeat in the capital. Thiago Santana gave them the lead again. This time he's netted in the 5th minute, a terrific header from a Ken Iwao corner before Yusuke Matsuo netted early in the second half and got lifted up onto Thiago's shoulders in celebration. And the substitute, Tomoaki Okubo, applied the icing on the cake 7 minutes from time. We can chat about Reds, guys, but we did have a late question come in from Gab Anello. He says, should we worry about Sagan Tosu? They've always been very good at dodging relegation scares, but this year the job seems harder than ever. Oh yeah, Gab, I had them in the bottom 3 in my J-Pred, so yeah, I think it's going to be a very tall order for them this season, and their start to the season hasn't changed my mind at all. You can see how hard they work for the coach, but I don't know whether it's the quality of the players that they've lost over the past few seasons is actually going to catch up with them or not, but bottom of the 5-game form table with just 1 draw from their last 5 games. And they're joint bottom with Sapporo above them only on goal difference. Johnny, I don't know, do you have anything to add on Tosu? I mean, this was a difficult week for them, and it continues on a rough start to the season, no question.
And to rehash kind of what Sean said earlier from Scott McIntyre's kind of opinion that don't always look at the results. I mean, the amount of times I went on last season about how bad Tosu performances or like how bad the statistics look from their perspective, but they were able to grind out results. Whereas this time round, you know, 7 games in, they've already lost like four games by 2 goals or more. So a lot of games like this one, it's not even been close. They've been behind for most of the game, and they just kind of get pummeled at times by Reds. And yeah, I can't really be too positive about Sagan, I'm afraid. But I think the biggest concern for me is that under Kawhi, they have this kind of brand of football that's like very, very high energy. You know, they cover a lot of distance every game. There's a lot of sprinting. They basically want to outwork the opponents and kind of close them down, win possession and take advantage of the few chances they get. And I mean, naturally, that style tends to be far less effective in the teeth of mid-Japanese summer and also to the back end of the season where everyone's a bit tired. So, I mean, what you've seen the past couple of years under Kawhi, they've actually started reasonably well like in the spring, like April and May, they pick up some results, and then they've fallen away quite badly, but they've always had enough points in the bank to keep them more than safe. I think this year, if you look at, if they get to the kind of back end of June and they're still in and around that bottom three, you know, there's not an awful lot of money to fix the problem in the summer. I really would worry for them a bit. It might be that, you know, this is their year. But yeah, if I can focus on Reds a little bit as well, because Thiago Santana, he got his goal from the penalty spot last week, and that seemed to give him a bit of extra confidence, and he really did what he's brought to do, which is score goals in the penalty box. And you know, that early goal takes all the pressure off Reds. They can then kind of, you know, just pick off Zagantosa at will on the counter attack. And you know, a big shout out to Yota Sato for his assist for the second goal for Matsuo. I'm sure Alex Schultz would have been proud of that, the way he kind of intercepts it inside his own half, carries it up to halfway, and a beautiful dink over the top for Matsuo. And yeah, I think Park Yo-Yu did his best, five saves, a lot of good work from him, but you know, all he did was really prevent it from being a cricket score. And this was a game, remember, that Sagantos like nicked a 2-0 win in last season. So again, it's another example, like last week against Fukuoka, where Reds are a bit more clinical, a bit more dominant at home, creating a lot of chances and not getting bogged down in 0-0 or 1-0 defeats at home. So that's a good sign from then. Yeah, I was a bit surprised as well what Sean said about Urawa are already up to fifth. But I mean, the table is so tight that they're only 3 points above 14th. So you're only a couple of bad results away from mid table. But definitely, I think more reasons to be positive. So I mean, Sean, you can take either or both Urawa and Sagan. Anything you wanted to add?
No, not really. I think you've covered everything. I think Tosu, yeah, they've. When you look at their players, again, it's not a terrible squad that they've got, but it doesn't look especially strong. I mean, Vinicius Araujo was a decent player from Montedio Yamagata, or maybe from Machida Zelvia. I forget which one he was quite good at. Montedio Yamagata, I think.
First. Machida, but he was great at Yamagata.
Yeah, but that was maybe 5 years ago now. Mm. I think he was at Ima Buddy last season.
Yes.
And again, you know, nothing against him, or you know, sometimes players need to take a sideways step or a slightly backward step to get things going again in their career. But you just think, well, he's not. Is he sort of the player that's guaranteed to get them the goals that they need to push on and stay up? The players around them as well. It's just Naganuma again, a bit like I was saying before about Asano for Sapporo. You wonder if, you know, he had a very, very effective season in terms of goals and assists last year, but is he able to do that regularly? With a lot of players, again, without wishing to cause Sagan Tosu or their fans offence, with a lot of them, you think, well, they're at Tosu for a reason. Other clubs aren't picking them up. They haven't managed to achieve things at other clubs at a higher level for a reason. So, I don't know necessarily if they've got much to be working with there. And with Reds, yeah, like I said before, I'm sort of surprised just based on the results and the kind of the sort of the atmosphere around them of, you know, how they're doing under this new coach. Things aren't going well. Obviously Schultz getting an injury, they've got all these players, Nakajima's basically just being used as a sub. They still haven't been able to keep a close eye on the starting lineups recently, but they still seem to be finding ways to squeeze in Koizumi and Sekine and these players that have just been around for a while and never really been able to deliver. Santana coming in, you know, last year at Shimizu, I think he had a couple of injuries and sort of personal issues that meant he wasn't playing it, sort of for the full season, but didn't go as well as many expected in the second division. So it was a slightly surprising signing that they still went with him the year after they reportedly were first trying to bring him in. But yeah, he's done well in the last few games, seems to be clicking into gear. And yeah, when you look at their squad, they are one of the teams that I feel like, yeah, as the season progresses, they can maybe start to click into gear if the coach starts to get his message through, if, you know, Schultz is back in. if they can find a way to get Nakajima playing to his best again, if Santana is starting to score every game, every other game, and things start to click, they can build up a head of steam and maybe, you know, do what Colbe did last year, where people are thinking, oh yeah, but they never quite make it. Oh, they won't be able to see it out. I think, you know, when you look at the squad they've got, there's no reason they shouldn't be pushing on and challenging right up with Sanfrecce and Machida at the minute. But yeah, as I said before, with only seven games gone, it's such a small sample of games and things to judge it on. It's really difficult to make any kind of hard and fast conclusions just yet.
No, that's very fair, Sean. All right, then. So, yeah, goals in three straight league games for Thiago Santana. He won't score from the halfway line every week, but, yes, it looks like he's up and running in his Reds career. And I tell you what, maybe Tosu, all they need is just to get Fuchi Honda back fit and firing. And, yeah, that could be the answer to all their troubles. All right, then. So the last two teams that we have to discuss played out a goalless draw at the Toyota Stadium. They're two midweek winners at Nagoya and Fukuoka, but both were left frustrated after a nil-nil stalemate. Grampus at another limp display, and Avispa at failing to take one of their numerous chances. Shahab Zahidi headed against the bar early on as he looked to follow on from his winner against Kashima on Wednesday with a goal in three straight games. But yes, his run of consecutive games with a goal stopped at two. But yes, Nagoya played without their best foreign players at either end of the pitch. We know that Kasper Juncker has been out for a while, and that was the question that Craig sent through. Does anyone know what's up with Juncker? Someone said he had a minor injury, but that was about a month ago. Yes, we haven't seen Kasper for a while. And yes, unfortunately for Grampus, Mitch Langerak was not between the sticks on Sunday. He appeared to pull out at the 11th hour. So we're not quite sure at of the extent of any sort of injury that Langerak might have or the reason for his absence from the team on Sunday. But yes, these two teams played out a nil-nil draw. Johnny, have you heard any whispers about what might be up with Juncker?
All I know is when I saw that question come in, I looked in his Twitter, and the last update from that time about a month ago, he posted in Japanese and translated it, said that I saw a lot of false rumours about me over the weekend. I want to make something clear. I got injured a few weeks ago. I'm currently undergoing treatment. I'm doing my best to return as soon as possible. Everyone is working hard to change the situation. Thank you. So, I mean, it doesn't necessarily say there it's a minor injury, although I don't know how all clubs work, but clubs tend to only release certain injury details. Like if someone's got surgery, but you could still have like kind of muscle injuries keep you out for like 6 weeks or 2 months. I'm guessing it's something like that, but I mean, I honestly don't know any more than that. And yeah, they've got Yamagishi got injured in the last game. Two games ago. But I mean, you still look at Nagoya, the one in midweek, but between that game and this game, they had 10 shots in total in the past two games. And if my memory serves me correctly, I think Sagan Tosu were the only team last year that averaged less than 10 shots per game. So, you know, they're unbeaten in four and they've only conceded two goals, but they're not really impressing anyone at all. And, you know, the crowd was down quite significantly at Toyota Stadium for this one. So I don't know if that's people voting with their feet or what the reason was behind that. But, yeah, it seemed like Fukuoka were the better teams. It's Zahidi, he's looked pretty good since he's come into the league. I'm guessing, you know, 0-0's not a brilliant result, but given how things have gone at times for both these sides, I don't think either side would complain too much with 0-0. So, I mean, Sean, do you have any more on Juncker, or maybe any thoughts on Kenta Hasegawa and the job he's doing at Grampus?
Yes, I saw the same tweet as you from Juncker, and he strikes me as, I've only spoken to him a couple of times, but from what I've seen of him on social media and whatever, he seems like the kind of guy who says it like it is. So I think if he had been dropped, if something had happened between him and Hasegawa, mm-hmm. I feel like he would probably come out and say it, or at least allude to something going on, mm-hmm. Rather than make up something about being injured. So I have no reason to doubt the fact that he is just injured and not fully fit yet. And as for Hasegawa, I mean, I think things are going pretty much as things go under Hasegawa. I don't, again, they're up in 10th. They started terribly, obviously, but you know, they're up on 10 points now. They're on the same points as Marinos, having played a game more. They're only a point behind Reds, point behind Tokyo, point behind Vissel. I mean, having started as badly as they did and still being able to kind of, you know, recover to that point, I wrote a piece ahead of the season picking them as my dark horse, not necessarily to win the league, but I thought they would do better than many people thought they would. And then obviously they started terribly and didn't score for the first three games. So that was why, you know, I thought, oh, that was my jinx again. I've done it again. I think they've got a solid squad there. I think they've got good attacking players. Morishima is starting to show flashes of what he was doing at Hiroshima before he left. If Yamagishi and Junker could get fit, that is an incredible partnership to have up top. The likes of Yamanaka and Kubo out wide can make chances almost at will. Defensively, obviously, they lost three probably of their starting five. Sort of, if you think of them as a back five, whatever, the sort of 3-4-2-1, including the wing bags with Morishita going as well, with Fuji going, with I always forget his name, Nakatani. Maruyama as well, obviously, was sort of, you know, in and out, but he's gone as well. So it's a lot of turnover. And for a team that is built around, you know, Kenta Hasegawa teams tend to be built around solid spines, it was, you know, there was always a chance it was going to take a little bit of time to for things to gel at the back. And if Langerak's injured as well now, obviously that's another big blow for them. You'd have to assume he's injured because, I mean, he started every game for about the past 5 years. And again, he's not the kind of person to be throwing his toys out the pram and kicking off. So I can't imagine there was anything sort of disciplinary behind that. So, I think certainly, I mean, obviously, if Nagoya still hadn't won after seven games and things weren't going well, then Hasegawa maybe would start to be getting nervous. But I think, you know, you'd assume that the powers that be at Nagoya knew what they were getting when they hired Kenta Hasegawa. They saw him, you know, what he was doing last year. So they obviously felt that they were willing to stick with it. And I think, yeah, they'll hopefully for them, as players start to get fit again, and that they should be able to push on and start looking up the table rather than looking over their shoulders.
All right, then. Thanks, Sean. So, that's our roundup then of match days 6 and 7 from the past week. Before we move on and have a quick chat about the under-23 Asian Cup, we better cover Sam's second question, Sean, and it's directed towards you, as Sam knows that you have worked with the J-League International YouTube channel. Do you have any insight into the reason for the reduction in available games to watch this year, and why the league seems reluctant to follow the K-League's lead in trying to grow interest around the world? I know this is a point of contention for a lot of our audience, and it frequently gets mentioned in our Patreon only line group as well, the reduction of games from four originally down to three, and now down to, seemingly down to two in each match day, and obviously that has disappointed a number of J-League fans from around the world. Do you have any insight into the reason for that?
No, I don't. Essentially, I'm sorry, Sam. I don't. I don't.
Certainly
know.
Not suggesting it's your decision or anything like that. I don't think. No,
I haven't heard anything. I have no idea why. I would assume is that the J League is looking to try and sell the rights more. I mean, you know, nobody wants to give stuff away for free. You'd assume that, you know, like any good dealer of addictive substances, you get people hooked with a free sample, and then you try to lure them in and pay you for it. All I could assume is that the J League have put those games out there, tried to build up an interest, show prospective broadcasters that, look, there's an audience, we've got this many viewers for our broadcast, for our live games, this is what we can provide you with, so that then those broadcasters can go to advertisers and say, how about this, is it worth it? So that is all I can think. And maybe, yeah, without wanting to fire any shots across the barricades at the K League, perhaps the J League is a more marketable division than the K League in terms of the way that the league has been built up so far, in terms of players going abroad from the J League, in terms of, you know, big name, again, air quote, players coming over to the J League. I feel like maybe that's what is behind it. Perhaps the J League is behind the scenes trying to negotiate deals to, you know, obviously there are countries around the world now that they do already have existing broadcasting deal with. Perhaps they're trying to expand upon those, because otherwise, yeah, I mean, there's it makes no sense. If that isn't the case, why would you make them available and then suddenly stop? It can't be that difficult if you've already got the feeds there to be able to provide. It's not like they're having to send camera crews out to stadiums specifically for those streams. So that's all I can think. And yeah, having seen the way that things are done in the league, they're not always sorted out. How can I put it? It wouldn't always be, you know, you'd think looking from the outside, well, they'll have to get something in place before the season starts. That isn't always the way that things work in Japan. They don't always look at things in that sort of black and white. So there's perhaps during the season, suddenly they'll announce a deal with some broadcaster or another is all I can think.
Yep. All right, then. Thanks for your answer, Sean. And thanks for your second question there, Sam. Much appreciated as always. OK, so let's wrap things up with a quick check on the Japan squad and schedule for the under-23 Asian Cup in Qatar. Manager Go Oiwa announced his squad of 23 last Thursday, which includes 5 players from European clubs and 1 university student. Forward Kotaro Uchino from the University of Tsukuba is the baby of the squad at 19 years of age. And we've mentioned several of the players from the squad who excelled in these past couple of top flight match days, the likes of Shota Fujio from Machida, Fuki Yamada from Tokyo Verde, and Kuro Yamatsuki of FC Tokyo, all got goals in the last couple of match days. Japan start their Group B campaign against China on Tuesday the 16th. Of April. They then play the UAE on Friday the 19th before wrapping up the group against South Korea on Monday the 22nd. The top 2 from each group go through to the quarterfinals. And actually, the major point I wanted to make is that if Japan make it all the way to the final 4, J1 players in the squad will definitely miss 4 rounds of matches, match days 8 to 11, and with a full round of Golden Week games on Monday, May the 6th, they'll be cutting it fine after the third place playoff and final are played at the end of the previous week. So potentially as many as 5 games missed by some of these players who are heading away to the Asian Cup. Johnny, did you have any thoughts on, or you wanted to give any special mention to any of the players in the squad? I mean, Gamba are represented by Riku Handa, and for me, FC Tokyo are going to be severely hit, of course. So yeah, in Matsuki and Ryotaro Araki, we have 2 big misses coming. But any other players you wanted to shout out for getting a gong from Go Oiwa?
I guess maybe one of the headline, other than Araki in attack, would be like Mal Hosoya, who's obviously been in the national team squad as he was for the full Asian Cup in January. And it'll be interesting to see how he goes, because he hasn't scored yet this season for Kashima. He still looks pretty sharp, like his movement and that. So I think he's the one you want to be kind of playing around. I think he's got experience at senior level, so you'd look for him to be leading the line. But it is a good attack with Fujio, Hosoya and Araki. And I know Uchino was a Yokohama F. Marinos youth player, and I think he was a top scorer on the Prince Takamado trophy. And I believe Marinos offered him a contract, but he went to university. So I'm sure we'll probably be seeing him in a Marinos shirt in a few years when he graduates. I mean, other than that, you've got the 2 kind of players at St. Truiden over in Belgium. That I noticed that South Korea, a couple of the clubs, I think Celtic and Brentford, I want to say, that refused to release players, because this is not an official FIFA window, but St. Truiden under Japanese ownership, they've Yamamoto Rihito, who's is on loan from Gamba, and also Joel Chima Fujita. He's going to be in the squad. I think Fujita is a really good player. I really like him. So I think he's someone I want to have a look at. And also someone I think who stood out for me in the game against the Ukraine recently was Kane Sato, who's over there in Germany. I mean, the first few times I saw him when he was at university, I couldn't really see what's getting him in these squads. He didn't seem to do an awful lot, but he's kind of grown on me each time I've seen him play. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him as well as Riku Handa, who I hope is better, because I think he had a stomach bug, which is why he wasn't in the squad at all for the Gamba's trip to Hokkaido, and I think he's going to be slightly late joining up with the squad. So yeah, mm-hmm. Hopefully he's feeling a bit better. Well, what about yourself, Sean? Is there one or two names you would pick out from that squad?
I'm still a really big fan of Fujita. I really, really like him. I know Matsuki tends to get the headlines and the hype, and he's obviously an excellent player. But there's something about Fujita. He just does everything really well. He's so confident, so powerful in the middle of the park, kind of player that you don't often see in Japanese teams, in Japanese national teams, certainly. I'm a big fan of him. For sure. And obviously, yeah, I mean, Hirakawa has been excellent. When he first sort of broke in at Machida last year, you thought, well, this is, he's useful. He came in from uni, looked like he was doing quite well, took to J2 very well. You think, OK, he's decent, but how's he going to kick on in J1? Will he get the chances taken to J1 as well incredibly quickly? There's been a lot of talk about quality of the squad, not being able to call up players from here and there. But, it's the same for... the same for every country. Not every country is blessed with players that are playing in Europe. And when you look at the squad as well, there's a solid, definitely, the best 11. You look at the best 11 and go, well, that should be good enough to finish in the top. Well, three is automatic. And then obviously the fourth, fourth place gets you a playoff as well. There's a few obstacles on the way. But I mean, if you want to get to the Olympics, you need to be good enough to beat those teams too. So, and as an Englishman, the Olympics is not the be all and end all. I know in Japan there is a big deal for them, but it doesn't really matter. Does anyone really remember, you look at someone like Wataru Endo is now playing for Liverpool and captain of the full national team. Is the fact that Japan didn't do very well when he went to the Olympics in, I want to say, 2016 in Brazil?
Yeah.
Ultimately, the results don't really matter that much. It's developing these players, getting them used to playing on those stages. So it's not the be-all and end-all. Obviously, I want them to qualify. Everyone wants them to qualify. But I think, they should have enough. But the same as at the Asian Cup, there are other teams there that are also good and on their day could beat Japan. So it'll be interesting. I think it's good. For players to develop, they need to be playing games where there's jeopardy. They need to be playing, where there's a real need to win, not just friendlies, not just exhibition games, traveling around, doing a tour here and playing against England, behind closed doors at St. George's Park, whatever. These are the kind of games where players are going to develop and learn and be able to grow, hopefully, looking further ahead. I'm quietly confident. I think, yeah. As long as they play like they did against Ukraine and not like they did against Mali, they should be okay.
Yep. All right, then. I'll be interested to see who gets the nod as the number one keeper. Leo Kokobo from Benfica B, Taishi Brandon Nozawa from FC Tokyo, and Kashima's backup keeper, Taiki Yamada, are the three goalkeepers in the squad. So, Kokobo has the number one shirt, so presumably he'll be first cab off the rank and get first crack at it. But we shall wait and see. A very interesting looking squad named by Mr. Oiwa. And I guess we might have more on them next week before they kick off on Tuesday the 16th. All right, then. So we're just about there, guys. Let's wrap it up with a brief look at what's to come in the next week or so in J1. We've mentioned it a couple of times already. Yokohama F. Marinos and Gamba Osaka will make up their game in hand from match day 3 on Wednesday night at the Nissan Stadium. And then over the weekend, match day 8 takes place. We have one game on Friday night, Kashiwa hosting Urawa, almost certainly a 1-1 draw. And then on Sunday afternoon, Johnny's Gamba Osaka host Tosu, with the other 8 games taking place on Saturday. And yeah, there's definitely a couple that I could pick out. Sean, we'll let the guest have the honor of going first. What is Sean's pick of Saturday? Sean's pick Saturday.
Oh, Jesus. You're throwing me under the bus here. Hang on a second. let me have a look. Right. No, not Gamba against Tosu. God, no. Hang on a minute. I'm going for Machida against Vissel. It's the current leaders against last year's champions. It's going to be another litmus test for Machida. Have they got what it takes? Can Vissel show the pretenders that they're not going to be pushed aside lightly, or are Machida going to defeat another one of them? They've already beaten, what, three former champions? Nagoya, Kashima, Kawasaki. If they beat Vissel, then yeah, they're going to show people that we're not to be messed with. So that one for me, and it's not a Nozota, so I can actually go and go and watch it because they're playing at Kokuritsu. So that's my pick of the week.
Not a bad one. How about yourself, Johnny?
Johnny's pick of the match day.
No, I prepared for Sean to go first, and obviously there's a big game that I'm going to let you choose. So I would actually choose Sean's pick of the weekend. I back that one up. But I'm going to go for Cerezo Kawasaki, which actually takes place at the same time as Machida Vissel Kobe. I think Cerezo quietly having a very good season, quietly efficient in recent weeks. And Kawasaki, as we've said, they're kind of teetering on 7 points from seven games. Kyohei Noborizato against his former long-time employer. So I don't think there'll be a ton of goals in this game, but I think it'll be an interesting game for probably a decent quality-wise. I'm sorry, Neil, but I'd probably back Cerezo to eke out a 1-0 or 2-1 win. But yeah, you never know with a Toru Oniki side. They always, when they look under the cosh, they've had a few bad results, they can battle back with something decent. So they might be able to pull a result out from somewhere. So yeah, I'm going to be making my Gamba debut this season, going to see Gamba Saga and Tosu, but I agree with Sean that that is not the game of the...
Oh God, I'm sorry, mate. you never know, it could be 5-4.
Well, Gamba have a horrible record at home to teams bottom of the league, so yeah, what 1-0 Saga and Tosu, I think. But yeah, Ben, I think we know what game you're going to choose. What's Ben's pick of Saturday? Ben's pick of Saturday.
Thank you, Johnny. Yes, it has to be the well, it's not the Tokyo Derby because of Machida is a Tokyo club as well. So it's one of the now many Tokyo Derbies that will take place this year. But it is the the original, and yes, it's returning to J1 for the first time since 2008. Verdy are the home team at Ajinomoto Stadium on Saturday afternoon, and should be an absolute blockbuster, a terrific occasion, and yeah, both teams coming off very positive results in the last couple of match days, so yes, that will be a tremendous occasion, I'm sure, and some really interesting games up and down the slate over all 3 days of the weekend in J1 match day 8. All right then, Sean, we'll leave it there. Your mate Scott said, let's try and get it under an hour. We all knew that wasn't going to happen. But we've really enjoyed having you on again and getting your thoughts on all things J1 and also on how the session 18 Kipu went. So, terrific to catch up with you, mate. And we look forward to doing so again soon.
You too, gents. Thanks a lot. And sorry, Scott.
All right then, that's it for this episode of the pod, Johnny. Once again, yeah, terrific to catch up with Sean, and some fascinating games over the last couple of match days to review.
Yeah, so I mean it's a long pod, but there's been 20 games of football played since we were last on, so yeah, hopefully we covered everything, and yeah, we've got a lot of good questions, so there was plenty of talking points, so yeah, it was a very enjoyable, a couple of hours well spent, I think, so thank you very much.
Yeah, I think we've done well to come in under 2 hours of actual recording time, Johnny. So, yeah, terrific job by all involved, including Sam, Craig, Spencer and Gab for their questions that added a lot to our discussion. So thank you very much, gentlemen. And yes, thanks to all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. And thanks to you, listeners, for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to review J1 Match Day 8. Speak to you then. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast.